Housing markets are a huge component of most economies. So how do you make sure people can actually afford to buy them?
In many cases, the easier route is taken. And what I mean by that is to resort to measures that make it easier to borrow money in order to buy a new home. So it supports the demand side from a debt-financed homeownership point of view. And that's not ideal. Ideally, we would like to see more supply-side measures.
In this episode, Andreas Adriano explores a new housing affordability index with Denise Egan, head of the IMF's World Economic Studies Division.
The newest issue of Finance and Development magazine out in early December looks at housing around the world. And one of the most important issues or the most critical problem about this is affordability. Denise Egan is a well-known researcher on this topic with a vast array of work, and she wrote about affordability for this issue, looking into the whys and how it happens. So Denise, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Andreas. It's great to be here.
So you developed this index, affordability index, that covers 40 countries. And in the article, you note how difficult it is to compare countries. So my first question is, how is the same problem happening in countries that are so different in terms of wealth, income, financial structure, depth of markets, even their cultural relationship with debt? Like we know, many European countries don't like to have debt. So how can that happen in such a widespread way?
That's a great question. And as you mentioned, the way we started thinking about this affordability was, how can we come up with one metric that would be comparable across countries and would capture the same concept, as opposed to, you know, going in one country and thinking about it, buying a home with own resources versus going to another country and thinking in terms of paying rent in a certain percent of income. So what we did end up coming up with is a concept from the debt-financed home ownership. Now, many countries, as different as they are, in many countries, buying a home is a big deal. Households do it once, twice in their lives. And more often than not, that involves borrowing some money. And that's what we're capturing in our index. And by definition, then what that means is we are looking at the income of a typical household in a given country. And we're considering the conditions in mortgage markets. How much does it cost? What is required to be able to afford a mortgage loan that would be enough to buy a typical home in their country? As you can imagine, one of the key ingredients that goes into that calculation, in addition to the median household income, the household size, and the size of the typical home, and loan-to-income ratios, loan-to-value ratios, is interest rates. And it's the interest rates, that component, that actually giving us a picture where housing affordability has become harder and harder universally across many countries. And that's related to then to the post-COVID surge. We have seen inflation and how central banks across the world have responded to that by increasing interest rates. So it's ultimately the interest rate movement that we think in the latest episode that made it a common problem across countries.
Is it right to think about affordability as the cost of housing and the cost of financing?
Yes. I mean, I did emphasize the cost of financing, but the other big component there is going to be the house prices.
And clearly there's an inflection point with the pandemic, right? So it seems like the pandemic raised the cost of housing, and then the post-pandemic period raised the cost of interest rates. So it's a sort of a one thing after the other.
Exactly. It's almost, you know, a storm gathering, first with the increase, the pressure on house prices, and then the increase in inflation and increase in interest rates. And those are related in some sense, but it was very interesting to see actually the surge in house prices themselves during the pandemic. Because you'll remember 2020, especially the first half, the economy, basically, with the lockdown measures and the people deciding that it was not worth the risk and staying in, economic activity collapsed and unemployment rose in many economies and incomes fell. And in those type of recession conditions, we would have expected house prices to also come down, because it's a good that becomes less affordable, it becomes, you know, less demanded, and you would expect to see prices to come down. It was very interesting to see during that period in 2020 especially, but then extending into 2021, house prices continued to increase even as incomes were not increasing as fast.
So interesting that you use the word storm. And one thing that caught my attention in your article is you saying that housing today is less affordable than during the period before the global financial crisis of 07 and 08. So how are we not in a crisis right now? Like, or is there a bubble and we're not seeing it?
Let me start by disentangling it a little bit. How come, by our metric, let me emphasize that, how come by our metric housing is even less affordable today than it was before the global financial crisis, which some people in real time, but definitely many of us with hindsight, did decide that it was a bubble in many economies, right? I'm going to again emphasize there the interest rate component of it. So what happened in the early 2000s in many economies, US, UK, Spain, Ireland, what happened was loosening of financial conditions, interest rates coming down, financial deregulation, so mortgages becoming less costly at a time when the economy was doing well, ended up creating these dynamics where house prices increased with demand increasing, pushed by, you know, cheaper credit. At the same time, the supply side also responding. And we had this combination of a housing boom in the sense that both house prices went up, but so did construction. So we had a lot of houses coming in into the market, and people continued to buy them at higher prices because they believed that prices would continue to increase, which meant developers continued to build. So this type of bubble dynamics were setting in. And when the crash came, or the turning point came, it started with, again, in some economies, central banks increasing interest rates. But ultimately, when prices started coming down, the economy coming down, central banks actually gave support by reducing rates again, right? So again, with our metric playing, the interest rates playing such an important role in our metric, then you would end up with this finding that although house prices were high, interest rates were not as high. We all remember, you know, even at their peak at that point, they were at 3%, 4%, and they came down even more in many advanced economies. Now, comparing it that to today, we have the combination of two things. House prices have been increasing even before the pandemic. And the reason is partly related to what happened in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, which was the excess buildup that was in the market. So all those houses that get started building in 2005, 2006, still not being in excess of what the demand in the market was. And as a result of that, developers also didn't build for a long time because they were getting rid of this excess stock in the market. So with economy doing well, rates being quite, you know, manageable, incomes increasing, what we had was a lot of housing demand coming in, but housing supply not as much responding. So that supported higher and higher prices as we went. And now we come into the pandemic with this type of dynamics, with strong demand and less strong supply response, tight supply conditions. And what the pandemic did was actually push this even further, right? We had higher housing demand because people needed more space. They wanted to get out. They wanted their own office space. They wanted to get rid of their roommates. There was much more demand. And at the same time, construction was affected. So whatever projects we had in the pipeline actually got delayed. So what we ended up is this strong demand but tight supply conditions further being amplified by the pandemic dynamics. Now, the last part of your question, are we again in a bubble and how come we're not seeing a total correction? Now, there are differences across economies and we need to take that into account. In some cases, in some economies, for example, in Europe, we have seen some correction. Prices did come down from their peaks.
In which countries?
Germany, for example, it has seen quite a bit of noticeable correction. Sweden has seen some correction. But in other economies, such as, you know, Canada, Australia, US, we have seen signs of some correction, but that was quickly quickly dissipated, and we have seen house prices again in nominal terms definitely, but also even in real terms starting to increase again. And what explains that? I'm going to go back to the supply there, and there is a lot of interesting new research happening. Entering that period with very tight supply, together with the increase in interest rates creating what we call a lock-in impact, is creating this very tight supply conditions and putting a floor on house prices, if you like think about it like that. What I mean by that is homeowners, current homeowners, with their, you know, fixed rate mortgages at 2%, 3%, they are very reluctant to put their home in the market and have to purchase a new property at much higher interest rates. So that normal churn we would see in housing markets with the existing home supply continuing to come in, that's not happening as it used to. And at the same time, higher costs, higher financing costs also affect developers because they need to keep working capital, they need to hire people, they need to buy construction materials, and this costs much more from a financing perspective nowadays. So we also have this reluctance from developer side to start new projects and bring in new homes into the market. Those tight supply conditions are hitting the strong demand also because of a very strong economy. In many cases, the 2020 recession was very sharp. It was very deep, but also the recovery was equally strong. And we have seen also with the governments intervening and giving support to households, we have seen incomes recovering, demand holding up. And one other factor to mention there is the demographics of it. So we have this in many advanced economies, especially, we have this cohort of people who are at household formation age. They are in their late 20s, early 30s, and they are looking to own their own home or at least get out of their parents' basement or where they're sharing with their roommates. So the combination of that, again, is this amplified imbalance between demand and supply in housing.
So basically what's saving us from the crisis now is that interest rates are high.
Partially. So as interest rates, as we all know, interest rates will start coming down. They have started coming down in many economies. They're not fully reflected. Policy rates are coming down. They're not fully reflected yet in mortgage markets. What might happen under this scenario? Actually, maybe counterintuitively or ironically, may actually support house prices again. And how that might happen is we would start seeing those locked-in homeowners come back into the market. But they will put their existing homes in the market, which will provide more supply, but they will also demand another unit to live in. So it's not that on the net, they're not really providing new supply into the market.
So just to pull on that, you mentioned the developers, so that means the supply side. And there seems to be across the board a supply-demand mismatch in this market. So there's a kind of a market failure there. Why does that happen?
Well, it's a combination of things. First, we need to recognize that this is, you know, in every country, construction is actually one of the most regulated activities, right? You need to get a permit, it can take time, you need to go through multiple permit processes. It's not only where you build, how you build, but there could be environmental requirements, there could be both more general government, but also local government requirements. So there's a lot going on there. And don't get me wrong, these are all regulations, rules put in place for good ends, right? We want houses that are built to a certain standard. They can withstand earthquakes. They can withstand hurricanes. So there are good reasons for them. But ultimately, what they end up doing is slow the process, make it more complex, make it more expensive. Hence, oftentimes, the supply response to price increases in the market can be actually quite low.
How is the picture different between advanced economies and emerging markets? I think something you said that is that people that are holding on to their very low mortgages right now, that's quite typically a U.S. Situation. I wanted to ask, one, whether this is also the case in other advanced economies, and second, how does that differentiate from emerging countries where, to begin with, for example, the interest rates start at a much higher level?
Yeah, you're right. The phenomenon, the locked-in phenomenon, is mostly visible in the U.S. because of its tradition, also, you know, policy-driven characteristic of having a mortgage market that's dominated by 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. So that's obviously a major place that we're seeing that. But that's at the period of low interest rates, low for long period, that was before COVID. That also changed the mortgage market structure in many advanced economies. So what I mean by that is if you look at the share of fixed rate mortgages that was in, say, early 2000s versus in late 2010s, in many economies, in many advanced economies in particular, we did see a shift. Rather than being adjustable rate mortgages, most origination of mortgage loans shifted to fixed rate mortgages. For example, in Spain, we have seen that. Right? So it's a, yes, US is the poster child, but in other economies, we're also seeing this locked-in effect in different extents. Now, in emerging markets, you're right, the rates are typically higher. And mortgage markets typically are less developed. And that's a caveat we actually put in. Our measure we have that's based on mortgage affordability may not be the most suitable to capture housing affordability in emerging markets. And we can see that in some of the statistics, in some emerging markets, it looks like, you know, it's impossible to get a house based on our metric. But obviously, people are buying homes. What's missing there is that we're not truly able to capture what you might think of as informal financing options. So people in some of these emerging economies often go to family and friends to get some, you know, down payment and then, or borrow even more.
In order Bank to of mom and dad.
Exactly. But the other thing about emerging markets to think about going to the, you know, the supply-demand imbalance, most emerging markets are also, you know, higher population growth cases, just the younger population looking to have a place to live on their own. But also most emerging markets also are still urbanizing. So we talk in aggregate terms, at country level terms, but within country movements also shift housing demand a lot. And in quite a few emerging markets, we continue to see large portions of rural population moving to urban areas and putting pressure or additional demand for housing in cities.
So Denise, to conclude, you spoke a lot about supply restrictions, and there's a major one that is upcoming, which is climate. So tell us how this can make the problem even worse, in a sense.
Absolutely. I mean, we did talk about tight supply from various reasons. And going forward, another threat, another challenge for governments is going to be how to respond to the vulnerability of existing housing stock. in many economies, housing has been built with in mind a climate that doesn't exist anymore or that's changing rapidly. That could be as easy as, you know, not thinking about air conditioning in some, you know, European economies because summers were cool enough, or building on coastal areas without thinking too much, having to think too much about the sea levels or hurricane frequencies. Now, what needs to happen is as economies need to add more housing to meet the increasing demand from pure population growth and household formation, they also need to be thinking about how to increase the resilience of their existing housing stock and to build again for those homes, those stock that's getting less livable, if you would. And again, this is pointing to need to think more from the supply side and how governments can navigate that, because housing ultimately is a basic human need, and it's just one of the expectations that people will have from their governments.
So many challenges ahead. Denise Egan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Denise Egan is chief of the World Economic Studies Division at the IMF and recently returned from a period at the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Andreas Adriano speaking with Denise Egan. Look for her article, The Housing Affordability Crunch, in December's Housing Focused Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.